please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new analysis shows that nearly 750 billionaires in the United States saw their combined wealth soar by $1 trillion in 2021, a 25% jump that, if taxed, would be enough to fully fund major priorities in Democrats' stalled Build Back Better package. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Wealth of U.S. Billionaires Rose $1 Trillion in 2021 as Build Back Better Stalls. Stay tuned for more. A new analysis shows that nearly 750 billionaires in the United States saw their combined wealth soar by $1 trillion in 2021, a 25% jump that, if taxed, would be enough to fully fund major priorities in Democrats' stalled Build Back Better package. According to fresh number crunching by Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, Tesla, and SpaceX founder Elon Musk led the billionaire pandemic profiteers with $118.2 in wealth gains last year, a 77% increase from 2020. Musk's single-year wealth gain alone, ATF found, would more than pay for Build Back Better's $109 billion plan to offer 6 years of free preschool for 6 million children. Former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, meanwhile, saw their net worths grow by $1.4 billion and $18.3 billion, respectively. U.S. billionaires now collectively own $5.1 trillion in wealth, ATF's analysis finds. By contrast, according to the latest Federal Reserve data, the bottom 50% of the U.S. population combined owns $3.4 trillion in wealth. While 2021 was a year of frustrated hopes and tighter budgets for most Americans, it was another banner year for the nation's billionaires, ATF Executive Director Frank Clement said in a statement. Crucially, under current law, the billionaires' massive windfalls in 2021 will go untaxed because they consist of unrealized capital gains, a massive untapped revenue source. ATF noted recently that enactment of Senator Ron Wyden's billionaire income tax proposal, which would subject the unrealized capital gains of the ultra-wealthy to taxation, could bring in enough revenue to fully fund a one-year extension of the boosted child tax credit, a program that lapsed last month due to Senator Joe Manchin's opposition. Manchin is reportedly demanding that the proposed one-year extension of the CTC boost, which has lifted millions of children out of poverty, be removed entirely from the $1.75 trillion Build Back Better Act, or most strictly means tested to limit eligibility. But Clement argued recently that Congress shouldn't be looking to cut Build Back Better investments, that will help working families afford healthcare, childcare, housing, and much more. He added, it instead should start taxing the spiraling wealth gains of America's handful of bloated billionaires to pay for those investments. The Washington Post reported last month that Manchin recently told the White House he would support some version of a tax targeting billionaire wealth as part of President Biden's Build Back Better economic agenda. But the West Virginia Democrat has not publicly offered any specific details on the kind of tax he would be willing to endorse, as he continues to block progress on the Build Back Better Act, which he falsely claims would fuel rising inflation. ATF tweeted recently, "Don't tell us we can't afford to pass Build Back Better and lower costs for the working families struggling most through the pandemic. Just make billionaires pay their fair share in the taxes."
The English High Court has decided that Julian Assange can be extradited to the United States. The High Court overturned a lower court's decision from January, which blocked the extradition of the Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder. Assange faces up to 175 years in U.S. prison for publishing diplomatic cables and classified documents, which show war crimes committed by the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. The High Court said that it trusts the assurances provided by the U.S. not to put Assange in oppressive prison conditions and to let him serve a potential sentence in Australia. A few weeks ago on this program, we debunked these assurances. I published classified documents from the case of David Mendoza, who was also extradited to the United States and given almost identical assurances that he could serve his sentence back home. These documents unquestionably prove how the United States violated its diplomatic assurances. In its ruling, the High Court said that it examined Mendoza's case, among others, and found no wrongdoing on the part of the Americans and nothing to suggest that the United States had violated its diplomatic assurances in the past or that it would do the same with Assange. With all due respect, the High Court could not be more wrong. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Before I explain the High Court's judgment, here's a brief recap to remind you where we are exactly in the Assange case. In January 2021, District Judge Vanessa Bretzer blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S. on health grounds. She found U.S. prisons to be too oppressive and that the conditions of Assange's confinement would lead him to commit suicide. A few months later, in October, the United States went to the English High Court and appealed against this decision on five grounds. Then, on the morning of December 10th, the High Court issued its judgment. I was there in remote attendance at the High Court, and I reported live as Lord Justice Timothy Holroyd read out the decision allowing the extradition of the WikiLeaks founder to go ahead. In its ruling, the High Court denied the U.S. appeal on three out of five grounds. These were grounds 1, 3, and 4. In essence, the High Court accepted that Assange suffered from a precarious mental condition. It accepted that the district judge applied the test correctly under Section 91 of the Extradition Act when she found his extradition to be oppressive. At the same time, the High Court did allow the U.S. appeal to go ahead on grounds 2 and 5. The High Court accepted the diplomatic assurances given by the United States and agreed that the district judge, quote, ought to have notified the USA of her provisional view to afford it the opportunity of offering assurances to the court. As we've highlighted before, these diplomatic assurances provided by the U.S. pose several problems. Just by reading them, you can immediately see that the United States has given itself a way out to avoid abiding by its promises. For example, the first assurance says, quote, the United States will not impose special administrative measures, SAMs, on Mr. Assange pre-trial or post-conviction. However, in the same sentence, it says the United States still reserves the right to impose SAMs if Assange were to, quote, commit any future act that met the test for the imposition of a SAM. So what does that mean exactly? What would meet the test for an imposition of a SAM? This is very ambiguous and unclear. The United States could frankly find any reason to say that Assange is threatening national security or some other excuse and then throw him in SAMs to spite him.
You're on your phone call like I was with a family relative, my mom. And I say to my mom on that phone call from prison, you know, tell my buddy that he needs to go see my attorney. Well, that in itself, the prison monitoring system kicks it back to security, their high level of review. And that just that simple comment would put him in a facility, probably ADI.
The United States also has things like communications management units, CMU, or special housing units, SHU, where it can lock prisoners up in isolation. The United States could easily place Assange in either of those and then say, we didn't break any assurances, we only said we wouldn't put him in SAMs. Yes, but the whole reason Assange's extradition was blocked in the first place is because of the isolation, the solitary confinement, the prison conditions that would make him take his own life, not to mention the extradition itself. So whether you put him in a CMU or SHU or SAMs, it's all the same and could still lead him to take his own life. Now, the second assurance provided by the United States is that, quote, if Mr. Assange is convicted in the U.S., he will be eligible, following conviction, sentencing, and conclusion of any appeals, to apply for a prisoner transfer to Australia to serve his U.S. sentence. As the lead U.S. prosecutor James Lewis put it, Assange can now look forward to going to jail in his home country, Australia. Now, here's the problem with this assurance. The United States cannot just snap its fingers and say, fine, you can go to Australia. Both the U.S. and Australia have to agree first. Now, under Article 3 of the Convention on the Transfer of Sentenced Persons, it clearly says that, quote, a sentenced person may be transferred under this convention only on the following conditions. F, if the sentencing and administering states agree to the transfer. I can personally confirm that so far Australia has said nothing about taking Assange. And the High Court judges know this. They even say it in the judgment. They say that despite Australia giving no indication, this cannot be attributed as a fault or criticism of the United States. Now, if Assange is extradited, he will be tried at the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of Virginia, commonly known as the Espionage Court, because it regularly uses the Espionage Act of 1917 against journalists and whistleblowers. Chelsea Manning, who gave classified documents to Assange, was tried here. The indictment against NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and Julian Assange were also unsealed here. Another person who was tried at this court under the Espionage Act is Jeffrey Sterling, who used to work for the CIA. In 2010, Sterling was accused of leaking classified information to a reporter about a CIA operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear program called Operation Merlin. He was charged under the Espionage Act and threatened with hundreds of years in prison, drawing comparisons to Assange. In 2015, Sterling was sentenced to 3.5 years imprisonment. This whole debacle came several years after he had been fired from the CIA when he tried taking them to court over racist treatment that he had been subjected to while working at the agency. Given his background in U.S. intelligence and being a former CIA man himself, I asked Sterling how likely he thinks it is that the United States could go through back channels and tell Australia, another Five Eyes country, not to take its own citizen, Julian Assange, to serve any potential sentence down under. You being having a background in the intelligence community, again, this is just speculation, but how likely is it that the United States has gone through back channels and told Australia not to take Assange? Because we know very well under Article 3F of the Strasbourg Treaty, both countries need to agree to the prison transfer. It can't be just the U.S. saying yes and then he's magically taken to Australia. Australia needs to say yes too. How likely is it that the U.S. can go to back channels and just tell the Australians not to take him?
I think it's very likely, if not, if it hasn't happened already. With individuals, the main thing with, related to this, the main thing with Assange is that the U.S. has engaged in character assassination for years upon years against Assange, characterizing him essentially as a terrorist and a danger to the national interest of this country. With that as the backdrop, the U.S. can refuse to provide any information with regard to Assange to any other country, particularly Australia, if they want to hold him. The U.S. can hold him indefinitely at the U.S.'s leisure and in whatever facility they would like to hold him. I was in a low security facility. I technically wasn't under the special administrative SAMS program or monitoring my communications. But again, I was never told that I was. I think the question is open whether I was or not. I certainly got a lot of responses from individuals about letters that I would receive, questions about certain phone calls, things like that. I wasn't limited in who I could email, yet it just felt like I was being monitored. One example, and I think this set off many alarm bells for the prison, if not the Bureau of Prisons. My wife sent me some Farsi language books so I could at least just try to maintain my language ability. She did that. I had no idea. It was only months later when they provided me the books. And I said, well, what? And I asked, what was the holdup? And they said, well, we've never seen that language before. And I know what they were saying. It looks like Arabic, and am I a terrorist sort of thing? And again, that is related to how the Department of Justice characterized me, and throw in the national security aspect. And that is certainly what is going to be the case with Assange. He is going to be in the most secure facility that they can find. The Bureau of Prisons can act in whatever way it wants. However, it will take guidance from the intelligence community with regard to how Assange will be held.
Even if Australia gives prior consent and agrees to the transfer in advance, under the prisoner transfer treaty, you could only request the transfer once your sentence has been finalized. That means if Assange is taken to the U.S. and he loses in court and they give him a lengthy sentence, which is practically guaranteed, what's the first thing Assange is going to do? He's going to appeal it. So he'll go first to the appellate court in that particular district, a process that could take around 4 years alone. Assange will eventually lose there as well, and then he'll ask to take his case to the Supreme Court. That could also take another 3 to 4 years, and that's if they even hear his case at all. Mendoza thinks that's highly unlikely.
I know what they're playing there, too. They're going to give him a long sentence, and then they're going to say, well, because you can't get transferred until your sentence is finalized. So they're going to tell him, if you want to get transferred, you've got to accept the sentence. You can't appeal it to the Supreme Court. And that's a game that they're going to play. They're going to write him out for another 10 or 15 years until that gets decided in the Supreme Court, if it does get decided in the Supreme Court, because many times the Supreme Court won't take the case. It'll sit there and dock it for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And then they just send you back a note later and say, well, we've decided not to accept this case.
In Mendoza's case, Mendoza wasn't just given a diplomatic assurance that he could serve his sentence back home, like they're telling Assange. Mendoza even signed a contract with the United States and Spain that he would be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. A contract is a legally binding document, and the United States broke it anyway. So what chance does Assange or anyone else stand? Now, another assurance given by the Americans is that once Assange is in U.S. custody, he would be given medical treatment to help with any physical and psychological ailments. The U.S. says it will ensure that Mr. Assange will receive any such clinical and psychological treatment, quote, as is recommended by a qualified treating clinician employed or retained by the prison where he is held in custody. Once again, you can see how ambiguous this is, because it doesn't actually guarantee Assange any medical care. It only says he'll get medical care if the prison physician agrees to it. Jeffrey Sterling was suffering a heart condition while in prison. When he asked the prison doctors for medical attention because of chest pains and shortness of breath, his calls for help fell on deaf ears. It took scores of people, including a U.S. senator, pleading on his behalf before he was finally given any medical attention.
When I was in prison, I developed heart issues. I had had previous issues with my heart. One day I felt like I was having a heart attack. I remember going to the medical staff, and they were completely blowing me off. I mean, their answer to me having chest pains and shortness of breath and breaking out in a sweat was to drink more water. I let my wife know what was going on, because where else was I to turn? And she rallied thousands of people to bombard the prison with emails, phone calls, And eventually, a U.S. senator reached out to the prison and asked what was going on with regard to my health and whether I was receiving health care or not. Only through that effort, that incredible effort, was I able to get the health care that I needed. Had I not, and in prison, there were many times where you could see, and you know, I've seen individuals who were dead, inmates who died because they did not receive proper medical attention. I was certainly fearful that I was going to be another of that number. And it took that incredible effort, spearheaded by my wife and my supporters throughout the world, for me to get just basic medical attention. And that is so typical of the U.S. prison system. The best way to describe U.S. prisons are they're just human warehouses, places to put bodies, categorize them, file them away, and forget about them. And any interaction is, again, perpetual punishment. So they will go out of their way, the staff, they'll go out of their way to abuse, neglect your needs, and really make life miserable. It's miserable enough being in prison, but they go out of their way to emphasize all of that to any inmate.
Speaking of medical assistance in prison, in the U.S. prison system, you know, I've been covering Julian Assange's case, and one of the assurances the United States government has given him is that once in U.S. custody, he'll receive medical attention under the recommendation of the prison physician, whatever that means. And there's one tweet that you wrote that says, quote, "I can guarantee that in a U.S. prison, he, meaning Assange, would not receive medical attention. It took the attention of a U.S. senator for me to receive proper medical attention," as you just recalled. Could you expand on that for us, you know, given your own experience, what you've seen there, what it would be like for Julian Assange, what it is like for others who are in the U.S. prison system?
Again, healthcare is an afterthought in U.S. prisons. They will go out of their way to make sure they're not providing any care for you. For anyone, any medical issues, the first position that is taken is that the individual, and also in my case, that the individual is faking, that just want attention or the opportunity to get outside the walls to go to a doctor. So there's the first step is to blame the inmate for the condition. The next step is to do nothing. And then the third, when people started reaching out early on, in my case, the most effort that they will put in is defending their position and calling everyone else a liar, or again, relying on, well, this it's not as serious as the person is taking it, all the while shielding themselves behind those walls, the prison walls, to not provide the care that they are supposed to provide. And I think that is across the board. That was in a U.S. prison when I was first arrested. I was at the Alexandria Detention Center. I received no medical care there either. I had just come off a month of, I was still rehabilitating from knee replacement surgery. It's quite a serious involved surgery. They provided absolutely no medical care for me there. In fact, they were giving me quote, painkillers that were contraindicated to the blood thinners that I was on. You make complaints about this, and it goes absolutely nowhere. I mean, if there is a home of bureaucracy, it is the Bureau of Prisons or any jail system.
Sterling also told me about the psychological torment that he was subjected to while in prison. He was neglected and threatened by the prison medical staff with solitary confinement if he didn't cut it out with feeling depressed.
Speaking of health, the other aspect is mental health. There will be absolutely no attention or any sort of assistance with mental health. When I was in prison throughout that ordeal that lasted for so many years, I was certainly suicidal at times. I was very down. My feeling was that my country has thrown me out. My country didn't want me. My country didn't believe me. So I was certainly mentally in a very bad state. I was called before the prison psychologist and threatened with being thrown in solitary if I didn't essentially cut it out. if I didn't stop being depressed, I was going to be put in solitary, which would, of course, made the situation even worse. But that is typical of the type of, and I use the term loosely, care that anyone in a prison system will receive. I don't even think there's a question of that. And the so-called assurances that the U.S. authorities have given to the U.K. courts aren't worth the paper that they're written on. It has really shocked me how the case, you know, throughout the entire proceeding has really been based on untruths, if not lies, about what Julian is going to be facing. One is that he would not receive 175 years. And they had the audacity early in the proceedings to highlight my case as a benchmark for the type of sentence anyone going up against the Espionage Act would receive. I was facing over 100 years. When the judge gave me 42 months, the prosecutor was absolutely livid. He was wanting far more than that. And that is exactly what Assange is going to face. Any assurances about not receiving a harsh sentence are incredible. I mean, it's just incredible that they would even make such a claim.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time. Just really appreciate you coming on, sharing your experiences with us, and your invaluable insight and knowledge. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I recently published classified documents of the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Spanish courts about the extradition of David Mendoza Herarte. He was also given similar assurances to those of Assange. In fact, he even signed a contract, as we just mentioned before. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case during the High Court hearings in October. In the High Court judgment, the judges say they examined Mendoza's and Abu Hamza's cases and found that, quote, neither provides any evidence of a failure to comply with an assurance, and neither provides any support for Mr. Assange's submission that this court should not regard the offered assurances as reliable. If you look carefully, just before that, they state that, quote, both can be said to show that the USA may be expected to apply the strict letter of an assurance which it has given. They're basically admitting that US assurances are so vague the US can get around them without really breaking them, and that is the whole problem. Now, when I read this, I'm frankly astounded. It sounds to me like the judges only read the verbal note, the diplomatic note, sent by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid in January 2009. But that is just one assurance in Mendoza's case. Now, diplomatic assurances can come in many forms, and Mendoza did receive another. He had a contract called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. This contract, this diplomatic assurance, was signed by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid, by the Spanish government and Mendoza himself. And it clearly stipulates that Mendoza must be sent back to Spain to serve his sentence. He cannot be given a life sentence and so on. Did the High Court judges in England see this contract at all? Because if the initial verbal note was vague, well, this document certainly isn't. The Acta de Entrega is a very crystal clear contract and a diplomatic assurance that the United States violated without a doubt. They blocked Mendoza's transfer to Spain three times and kept him in the U.S. for almost 7 years. This is all in the documents that I published. Now, I can tell you that these documents were never shown or cited in any of the Assange court proceedings as of yet, which makes me wonder, did the judges even get a chance to examine them at all? How can they arrive to such a conclusion after looking at Mendoza's case? Because if they're missing all these documents, it's simply impossible to understand what happened. The High Court's decision to allow Assange's extradition to the United States is extremely disturbing on several fronts. instead of pointing this out, instead of pointing out that this indictment criminalizes national security journalism, the corporate media, the mainstream media, are just joking around and gloating at the prospect of someone going to prison for the rest of their lives. For what? For doing their job as a journalist, which is something the people at MSNBC and CNN and the BBC know nothing about. Now, the High Court accepted that Assange is suicidal, that the extradition would be oppressive, but they also decided to trust the United States. They trust the U.S. to treat him well. And I must say, I'm shocked at this ruling. I don't understand how they could come to such a conclusion, especially after they say they looked at other extraditions like Mendoza's. Now, Assange's legal team have 14 days from the decision to request an appeal at the Supreme Court. Stella Morris, who is Assange's partner and also on the legal team, has confirmed that they will be doing this. When Assange is in court, they're not discussing press freedoms anymore. They've already criminalized that. And right now, they're discussing how he's going to be treated in U.S. custody and whether he'll kill himself because of how bad the prison conditions are. They're discussing whether these diplomatic assurances can be trusted. The answer is no. And that's what people must fight to highlight right now. That's why right now Mendoza's case is more important than ever, because it exposes how the United States and its promises cannot be trusted. I can tell you, the documents that I published were never mentioned as of yet in the courtroom during Assange's extradition proceedings. So whether the High Court judges have actually seen these documents, I don't know. But if they did see these documents, if they did see how the U.S. broke its assurances every single day for almost 7 years when it kept Mendoza in the U.S. and denied his transfer application 3 times, then I simply don't understand how they came to the conclusion that they can trust assurances for Assange, because they are terribly, terribly mistaken, and time is running out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Cronin, writer. This article is titled, EU Admits Teaming Up with Israeli Regime Police Enables Mass Surveillance. Stay tuned for more. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Over the past few years, a project named Roxanne has been examining how criminals can be identified with the aid of speech recognition technology and visual analysis. Material intended for public consumption presents the EU finance project costing $8 million as benign. However, serious ethical issues have been raised when it was discussed behind closed doors. Internal EU documents obtained under Freedom of Information rules confirm there is a risk that Roxanne's results will be used for mass surveillance. An ethics check on the project conducted during 2020 refers to plans that personal data will be shared between the EU and the Zionist regime. The data collected during the project will incorporate special categories such as details on the genetic traits, health, lifestyle, political opinion, religious or philosophical conviction of individuals, according to that paper. The surrounding questions have become even more pertinent since the ethics check was carried out. Painstaking investigations by human rights groups proved last year that the Zionist regime's Pegasus spyware is being used more widely than was previously known to monitor campaigners and journalists in various countries. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry are among the participants in Roxane. A condition of their involvement is that all data they export to the EU should be collected lawfully. Providing assurances of legal behavior is apparently deemed sufficient for the purposes of EU ethics checks to demonstrate that privacy issues are being treated seriously. In the real world, an Israeli assurance is completely worthless. The Zionist regime's police are seeking new powers that would allow greater surveillance without requiring warrants. A key proposal is that cameras in public places could be used to match people's faces with details found on police databases. Such a recommendation should, in itself, disqualify the Zionist regime's police from Roxane, which pays lip service to the principle of privacy awareness. There are, of course, numerous other reasons why the Zionist regime's police should not be benefiting from EU science grants. One major reason is that the Zionist regime's police are institutionally racist. A recent Human Rights Watch report on Lid, a city within the occupied Palestinian territories, also known as Lod, contains a vivid example of police racism. The report describes how police fired tear gas and stun grenades at a protest by Palestinian citizens of occupied territories in Lid last May. Yet, in some cases, when Jewish extremists attacked Palestinians in the same city that month, the police either stood by or failed to protect Palestinians from harm. The Zionist regime's police and public security ministry both have their headquarters in East Al-Quds, which has been under military occupation since 1967. Doing business with them should, by definition, be off-limits for the European Union, which is nominally committed to avoiding action that would lend the capture and colonization of East Al-Quds any legitimacy. There are strong indications that the Zionist regime has not been entirely candid with administrators in Brussels. Documents for Roxane project give an address inside the occupied territories as the official contact for the public security ministry. If Brussels officials consulted the ministry's website, they would learn that its main offices can be actually found on Clermont's Gano Street in East Al-Quds. The involvement of the Zionist regime's police and public security ministry in Roxane and another EU-funded project called Law Train has sparked protests from the Palestine Solidarity Movement. More protest is needed. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry have been admitted into at least 8 other projects under Horizon 2020, EU's current research fund. Among them are 2 border surveillance initiatives, Andromeda and Safe Shore. As border surveillance has become synonymous with cruelty toward refugees, questions must be asked about the precise role being played by the Zionist regime's racist police. A particularly troubling aspect of all this cooperation is that boasts made by the Zionist regime police are seemingly taken at face value. An EU-funded project called Shuttle is building a database of blood, gunshot residues, hair, and saliva. The Zionist regime's police force is taking part and will contribute its experience as a forensic expert and technological leader, according to Shuttle website. There is no acknowledgement that the Zionist regime is actually an expert in operation. By awarding research grants to the Zionist regime police, the EU is rewarding a force that detains Palestinian children, terrifies entire families by invading their homes, and opens fire on worshippers in Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque. The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. Shortly before Hesham Abu Hawash ended his hunger strike earlier this week, EU diplomats proclaimed themselves seriously concerned about his health. The diplomats were not concerned enough to demand that the EU stop cooperating with the Zionist regime's public security ministry, the regime's department overseeing the prisons where Abu Hawash and many other Palestinians are locked up without charge or trial. In December, an agreement was signed so that the Zionist regime can benefit from the EU's next research fund. Named Horizon Europe, the fund has an overall budget of approximately $110 billion. Predictably, the EU promoted the new agreement by celebrating how its cooperation with the Zionist regime has supposedly brought great advancements in medicine and environmental protection. Just as predictably, there was no mention that the cooperation is a cash cow for the Zionist regime's racist police.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. The countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard. The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured, we'll revive and we'll prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why the such system can have a stronger economy compared to others, I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the Byzant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Diaozhao, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's overissuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the U.S. dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the U.K. And then the U.S., reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year.